especially welcoming the Milwaukee School of Law, Education, and Public Service. Would the students please rise? Thank you for being here this morning. You may be seated. And we have Lodi High School. Would those students please rise? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have Heritage Christian School. Would those students rise? Good. Good seeing you all. You may be seated. Students are with us with a program sponsored by this co-ed and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students from around the state are invited to join the court to listen to an oral argument and then meet with a justice after our second case. That discussion with the justice will relate to the procedures of the court in hearing and deciding cases, not on the substance of the case involved. And anyone who wishes to attend those proceedings at about noon, you're all welcome. The students also have gotten briefs and other materials about the case, and they have had activities in their classroom relating to this case. There is a discussion of the case, a summary of the case, is available if you don't have one and want it in the foyer. And if you, rather than have a lot of motion in the courtroom, if you raise your hand and want this summary, the marshal will give it to you. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Patience Robinsack. She will be the justice with whom you'll meet at noon. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. And to my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. And I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. And to my immediate left is a vacant, empty chair. And ordinarily, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley is seated there, but she will not be participating in this case. Next comes Justice David Prosser, and on the far left is Justice Lewis Butler. So I will call the first case, but I am not participating in it either, and the presiding judge will be Justice John Wilcox. First case is 03AP2755, John Marta versus the Board of Regents of the UW System. Arguing first is Aaron Halstead, representing Mr. Marta.
May it please the court, my name is Aaron Halstead and I represent John Marta, the petitioner. This case is a case that is critical not only for the rights of John Marta, who was a tenured faculty member in the University of Wisconsin system, but in fact for all tenured faculty in the UW system. The procedural, much of today's case relates to procedural questions in this case that led to where we're at today. And we believe it's important that we briefly state again the chronology and the procedural history. In May of 1999, the Chancellor at the University of Wisconsin Superior, Julius Erlenbach, served on Dr. Marta a statement of 18 charges. Those charges claimed that Dr. Marta had engaged in misconduct and other improprieties which the Chancellor said merited Dr. Marta's termination. A two-day evidentiary hearing was held before the Campus Faculty Terminations Committee in January of 2000. And after 2 days of hearing, which involved calling witnesses and the admission of approximately 200 exhibits from the parties collectively, the Terminations Committee at the Superior Campus issued a recommendation rejecting the Chancellor's call for Dr. Marta's termination. And I quote briefly from what the committee on the UW Superior campus said, quote, "The committee is quite disappointed that the administration would bring such serious charges and be prepared to exact its most severe punitive action based upon the state of the evidence or lack thereof that was presented at the hearing of this matter. The administration's case should have been thorough and compelling. It was not. Close quote. At that point in time, with a unanimous committee recommendation, if the Chancellor intended to do anything, make any recommendation to the Board of Regents that was differed substantially from that which the committee on the campus had recommended, he was obligated to provide his own written recommendation first to that committee prior to submitting it to the board, so that the committee would have the opportunity to provide a written response to that. The Chancellor did not do that. In fact, instead he sent a written recommendation, we allege, to the Board of Regents without first consulting with the campus committee. That consultation was required by UWS Administrative Code, Section 4.07. When the case got to the Board of Regents level, the board essentially delegated or charged a subcommittee of the board, which is known as the Personnel Matters Review Committee, with two tasks. First, the board said that that committee, the PMRC, was to study this matter, and secondly, it was then to make a recommendation to the full board regarding the Chancellor's recommendation for Dr. Martyr's dismissal. The PMRC's first recommendation was in March of 2001. It recommended that the charges against Dr. Martyr be discontinued without prejudice. In our petition for review from the ultimate board decision, we allege that at that meeting, the president of the Board of Regents said, quote, the board received the PMRC's recommendation, and that's it, close quote. That we also allege that the chair of the PMRC said, regarding those proceedings, that the board intended no further proceedings related to the chancellor's recommendation. However, shortly thereafter, without any prior notice to Dr. Martyr, the board met and remanded the case for further proceedings before the PMRC. The PMRC then entertained oral argument from the parties and submitted a second recommendation to the board, in which it recommended that the charges be dismissed, not without prejudice, but with prejudice. The board then remanded the case to the PMRC for a second time, and the PMRC took the case up a third time, and then in June of 2001, again recommended dismissal of the charges against Dr. Martyr. Now, it wasn't until recently, because of a public records action that we filed against the board, that we were even able to obtain copies of the second and third PMRC recommendations, but those are now part of the court's record. They were not at the time that the Court of Appeals had the case. After the PMRC submitted its third unanimous recommendation for termination of the proceedings against Dr. Martyr, the board then met on an ex parte basis with the Chancellor, Dr. Martyr's adversary in these proceedings. The Chancellor at that point remained represented by attorneys from the Office of the General Counsel, and the Chancellor's attorney met also with the board, but again, to the exclusion of Dr. Martyr. At that point, prior to any decision by the board, there had been four unanimous committee recommendations collectively between the campus committee and the PMRC in favor of Dr. Martyr. However, immediately following the Chancellor's ex parte meeting with the board met in open session and voted to fire Dr. Martyr.
Mr. Halstead, can you tell us what authority you're relying on for the right of your client to be present at that board meeting, the last board meeting where the recommendation for termination was approved?
Yes, Your Honor. We rely on Section 227.50, subsection 1 of the statutes. And Section 227.50 sub 1 says that in no contested case proceeding shall the hearing examiner or any other official of the agency involved in the decision-making process receive any ex parte communication from a party to the proceeding or any person who directly or indirectly would have a substantial interest in the proposed agency action, or an authorized representative or counsel.
Does that section apply even over any regulations by the university itself?
We believe, in fact, that it does. The contested case statute, which is in Chapter 227, contains a number of procedural protections for not just a tenured faculty member, but any person who would be subjected to an agency decision such as the board's decision. It provides them with all sorts of procedural protections, including the right to be free from a decision that involves an ex parte communication between the tribunal and a party.
Well, counsel, how would you respond to Section 227.50(1)(c)? This subsection does not apply to an ex parte communication which is authorized or required by statute. Now, as I understand opposing counsel's argument, you have a contrary statute that arguably authorizes this ex parte communication in 3611 sub 5, which allows for the agency to create rules regarding termination. And then you've got the rules in
Chapter 4, UWS.
Chapter 4, exactly. So how would you respond to the argument that, wait a minute, we have statutory authorization here through the other statute and through the express rule, and after all, shouldn't we be harmonizing statutes to read out any conflicts?
In fact, our position is, Your Honor, that while Chapter 36.13 does, in fact, permit and authorize the board to adopt rules, and it does authorize and require that the board give notice and conduct hearings if the board is going to proceed to terminate a tenured faculty member, it does just that. It authorizes the board to create rules. It does not either permit or require that the board adopt any rule that would allow an ex parte communication between a tribunal and a party. If that were the case, we would have a situation in many employment decision-making cases in Wisconsin or administrative agency cases where, because of the authorization for an agency to create a rule, ex parte communications would be allowed. I can think of various agencies before whom my clients appear, the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission, the Department of Workforce Development, which has cases involving equal rights, workers' compensation, and unemployment insurance, where those agencies are permitted and, in fact, required to adopt rules to conduct their hearings. However, the fact that an agency is permitted or required to adopt rules for the conduct of hearing does not mean that it can adopt a rule that would contravene a statute. There's no statute that permits an ex parte communication between the board and a chancellor seeking the termination of a tenured faculty member.
Counselor, doesn't your obligation depend on our conclusion that this was a contested case hearing?
The argument, insofar as we base it on Chapter 227, does depend upon this Court's conclusion that the contested case proceedings or that the contested case requirements apply to this case. However, we also argue in the alternative, and the Court of Appeals agreed with this, that Chapter 4 itself requires that a party be apprised of all evidence that's going to be offered against the party, that it be permitted to respond to any arguments that are made. And moreover, constitutional protections are important in these cases. Even if this Court were to find that neither Chapter 227 nor UWS 4 create a right to be free from ex parte communications, the state constitution and the federal constitution would not permit a hearing tribunal to have conversations ex parte with another party to the exclusion of the tenured faculty member. And so, to the extent that we argue 227.50 applies in this case, yes, in fact, it is dependent on the contested case paradigm.
In regard to the communications would have to be substantive in order to have an impact on your arguments to us, as opposed to procedural communications, correct?
I think that certainly we would agree that any substantive communication would violate that ex parte prohibition. We also submit to this court, though, that it would be inappropriate for the board to even permit a party to appear before it to make argument, regardless if that party is introducing substantive evidence or new information.
Argument I would consider substantive also. Procedural is in the way I was phrasing my question, wouldn't include either a legal argument or a factual predicate that hadn't been presented before.
If I cannot imagine a situation where the board would be having the chancellor meet with it to advise it regarding procedure. And the board hasn't made that argument that the communications between the chancellor and the board were merely those in which the chancellor came in and said, here's what I think the procedure should be. It would depend upon what that procedure is, whether the procedure could potentially affect Dr. Martyr's rights in terms of how the proceedings are going to be carried out or who's going to be allowed to do certain things. And so I'm not certain I can answer that in a vacuum. I would say that we would need to know what the alleged procedural communications were.
So that was somewhat what the Court of Appeals had suggested, though, is that it go back down to find out exactly what occurred at that last meeting before the vote that the Board of Regents took, correct?
That's true. In fact, Justice, we have sought throughout these proceedings to have the right to discovery so that we would be able to find out what was happening, and the Circuit Court refused to allow us to engage in discovery, which is permitted under Section 227.57 sub 1, where you're alleging a procedural irregularity.
Right, but again, we get back into, was this a contested case, and is that the appropriate section, where it seems that the administrative code, even if that is the appropriate section, does provide some relief, and that your client, under the administrative code, you argue to us, has the opportunity to know what went on at that session if any new information, factual or legal, was provided.
Again, Justice, we would submit that while we believe that it's imperative that this court recognize that the contested case statute apply to the termination of a tenured faculty member, if you set aside the state statute and you set aside even the administrative code that the board has adopted, constitutional principles would prohibit any type of communication that relates to the merits, because Dr. Martyr, being tenured, would have a protected property interest. And under this state's precedent and the United States Supreme Court precedent, it would be inappropriate for, constitutionally, for a tribunal to deprive a tenured faculty member of the right to notice of what the charges are. And so even if you set aside all statute, all administrative code, constitutional principles would protect Dr. Martyr in this situation.
But you get back to the substance of what occurred again, Counselor, because if they went in there and they said, gee, you know, next week we've got to schedule this, we've got to schedule that, and the conversation had nothing to do with your client, there's no constitutional abridgment. So we have to know what went on in order to see if your argument has any merit, correct?
I believe that the court certainly has the court certainly has an interest in knowing what is going on. However, let me speak to, because we have gone beyond talking at this point just about the contested case statute, and we're really talking now about the remedy in this case.
Mr. Halstead, before you go there, since you were talking about discovery, I'd like to touch on that a little bit. My understanding is the Circuit Court said no discovery. The Court of Appeals said discovery may be permitted by the Circuit Court. Do you have any argument in terms of your right to discovery other than through Chapter 227? Let's assume we find 227 doesn't apply here. Do you have any other argument that would justify discovery?
I have no other argument under the statutes. However, I do believe that in this particular case and in others similar to this case, that in the event that Dr. Martyr were deprived of the right to discovery in order to find out what happened in any ex parte meeting, whether there were other ex parte conversations regarding this case, which are among the other allegations here, that ultimately he would be entitled under the United States Constitution to discovery in the not in these review proceedings, but in another proceeding, he would be entitled to such discovery. However, in this case, only 227.57 sub 1, to my knowledge, would authorize discovery in the circuit court.
Well, why is discovery essential if you're going to have a hearing anyway to determine by the circuit court whether or not new material was presented at the hearing before the Board of Regents? Can't you find out what you need to know there?
Well, we've made other allegations that are factual allegations that are disputed. Among those are that after the campus hearing committee made its recommendation to reject the chancellor's charges, that the chancellor violated UWS Chapter 4 by failing to consult with the campus hearing committee before he went to the board, because the board was entitled to know what the chancellor's recommendation might be, a proposed recommendation, and to have the opportunity to respond to that in writing before he made it. But the chancellor did not permit himself the benefit of hearing what the committee would say, and we allege went to the board before even conferring with them. Now, the board denies that. So that's a factual allegation that we believe would merit discovery in this case. We had also sought to use the right to discovery to find out what exactly it was that the PMRC had recommended to the board on the second and third occasions after the remands, and the board refused that. So we wanted to get that through discovery and ended up getting it through a public records action. So I can't say that only this one meeting is that the circumstances of this meeting present the only facts that might give rise to discovery.
Mr. Hoss, if I may, could you explain why the university is so determined that dismissals not be contested case hearings? And then what is your answer to that? What is the policy reason that the university is so determined that these not be contested cases?
Well, I think in this particular case, Justice Prosser, the reason that the university is determined that the contested case statute not be applied is that they argue that they have the right to meet ex parte with their chancellor. In fact, what's very concerning to us in terms of even relying upon what the board might say happened during this meeting, or relying on the board to say that it's going to sit impartially to judge what the chancellor's recommendations might be, are statements that the board has made. The board has told the circuit court in this case that it considers itself to be the same legal entity as the chancellor, and that it believes that, quote, the chancellor and the board are part of the same decision-making body in this case, close quote. And the board went on to tell the circuit court, quote, it is absurd to suggest that the board could be prohibited from consulting in private with its own chancellor regarding his personnel recommendation, close quote. So the board is aware that if the statute is applied in this case, then what it did was wrong, that it shouldn't have been conferring with the chancellor ex parte, and that it has violated the law. And I think that that's extremely not just bad policy, but constitutionally unsound. That, I believe, would be the ramification of this court finding that the contested case statute applies, that it would undo what the board did 4.5 years ago when it met ex parte with the chancellor.
So just explain your position. I'm having a hard time understanding, at least through the briefs, the position you're taking as far as discovery. You also want to discover, if I understand it, that there were certain conversations which may or may not have taken place between the chancellor and a member of the Board of Regents.
Sure.
Now, it seems to me that in any of these hearings, if this court would allow that, excuse me, then it becomes just standard. In all these hearings, they could have had a phone conversation, they could have walked down the street together, they could have had lunch together, and there were three of them. This board is made up of, quote, citizens that have been appointed by the various governors of this state to the Board of Regents, and this is sort of free-flowing to me. You seem to think that if two people are together or seen together, that you're entitled to find out what they talked about.
No. I don't believe, Justice Wilcox, that that is the position that we've taken. The position that we've taken is this, that at the most critical juncture in this case, that if after we had litigated this case before the campus committee and the PMRC to the point where it made three unanimous recommendations, that I was, that at the board meeting in Milwaukee, I was made to stand out in the hall while the other party in the proceeding walked into a room with the chancellor to meet with the board, made me stand out in the hall, and then came out, allowed me to come in finally, and then said, we're going to vote on this, voted to fire my client. I then learned that the person who made the motion to fire Dr. Martyr had flown from Superior in his private aircraft with the chancellor to that meeting. Now, in this particular case, there are facts that caused us to, that developed at the time that this hearing occurred that made us suspect that something was amiss. And I believe that just as if you're going to file a lawsuit, in any case, you don't just go filing lawsuits because you think you might find something. You know something ahead of time that causes you to wonder whether your client's wrong rights have been violated, and then you ask for the right to discovery to learn whether what you believe to be the case is correct. And here, the board has admitted one of the most foundational facts in this case, which is that it met with the chancellor to my exclusion and to the exclusion of my client, Dr. Martyr.
Now, I understand your point about meeting with the chancellor, but I want to follow up Justice Wilcox's question. Other than the fact that the particular regent flew with the chancellor to the hearing, is there any evidence that you have or are alleging that would relate to improper communications about the proceeding?
As far as that particular, I know nothing about what happened during their conversation. To my knowledge, it was only the two of them, and no one could know what happened.
How do you overcome the presumption of that they're acting appropriately?
The statute says that in terms of discovery, that you're permitted, that the court may permit discovery if proper cause is shown. That is general proclamation. There's nothing that says specifically what kinds of facts you must allege. And I know of no other situation where a party, let's say in civil litigation, where in order to take discovery, you first have to show the court, I have enough facts to show you to even permit me to start a deposition and begin to ask questions of the witness.
But my understanding, based on what you just referred to, is that we're dealing with an erroneous exercise of discretion standard with the trial court. Is that correct?
That's true.
And what did the trial court do wrong here?
The trial court made its conclusion, and only a conclusion, that it would not permit discovery. The only thing that it said, the circuit court in its decision, was discovery is not needed for this court to make its decision. There are no facts that underlie that decision. The court didn't explain why it had reached the conclusion that discovery wasn't necessary. It's just an assertion. And that's exactly the kind of thing that this court has said circuit courts cannot do. They cannot make bald assertions or conclusions without explaining how they reasoned to that conclusion.
And at the point that the court reached its conclusion, it had ruled in your favor. Is that correct?
It ruled that the matter should be remanded to the board. It did find that Chapter 227 had been violated, but we were arguing and have continued to argue that the appropriate remedy here would be reversal because of statements that the board has made, which amount to saying that the board and the chancellor are on this side of the table together and we're over here. And that's not the way that this is supposed to work. The board is supposed to sit up there while the parties litigate. It isn't supposed to consider itself to be the same decision-making body as one of the parties, as it has told the circuit court. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Halstead.
Steve? Could I ask, where is Professor Martyr now? Is he part of the faculty?
No, he was dismissed from the faculty in June of 2001.
Okay, so if we give you what you want, what does he get, 3 years or 4 years?
I believe he would be entitled to all of the make-whole remedy that any party would be entitled to under the state statutes or the Constitution where they've been deprived of a property right without due process. That would include whatever monetary relief or other make-whole relief as would be appropriate.
Would he get his job back?
I think he would, because he would be restored to the status quo ante prior to the board's decision in June of 2001, before the violation of the law occurred.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Attorney Lattice.
Your Honors, I'm Jennifer Lattice, Assistant Attorney General. I'm proud to represent here the Board of Regents for the University of Wisconsin in this case. We're asking the Court, Your Honor, to recognize the excellent job that the Court of Appeals did in analyzing the case and affirming it in all respects, including those respects, I add, that are not favorable to my client in this case. I believe the Court of Appeals analyzed it and handled it appropriately with respect to the two major questions presented by the case. First, should Chapter 227 contested case process have been applied by the Board of Regents? And secondly, if not, did the Board properly apply procedures? And as a subset of that, if not, what is the proper remedy? Now, addressing the issue first as to whether Chapter 227 procedures applied, I'd like to note that the Court of Appeals properly found contested case procedures do not apply to discipline and termination procedures involving tenured professors. That is because in Wisconsin Statutes 36.13 sub 5, the legislature directed the university to come up with a specific procedure for the termination of tenured faculty members. And the university has done that via UW System Chapter 4. Now, it's well settled in the law that where there's a specific process, that should be the general process applied. In reviewing the plaintiff's reply brief yesterday in preparing for this argument, Your Honors, I discovered that, in fact, this Court has said that before. I regret that I missed this case in my own brief, but it is cited in the plaintiff's reply brief, Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District versus the DNR, 126 was second, 63, 1985, at page 73. And this Court has said in that case, in essence, the contested case statutes create a residual hearing right. That is, they serve as a safety net, affording a hearing right to those who are not granted a specific right to a hearing by other statutory provisions or administrative rules. And so that is the answer to that question. That's what the Court of Appeals held, and that's what we're asking this Court to affirm. Essentially, the concept of expressio unius est exclusio alterius, forgive my Latin pronunciation, but you know the concept well, the express mention of one matter excludes other similar matters not mentioned. Having instructed the UW in Chapter 36 to adopt a hearing process for termination or discipline of tenured professors, the legislature intended to deny the application of the general contested case procedures. There was no reason for it. You also know that at least one court, Judge Crabb, in a case that I have cited in the brief, has found that procedures provided in UWS 4 do comply with constitutional due process. And they are specifically adapted for this situation, providing for things that the contested case procedures don't really look for. For example, the individual in this case is entitled to a peer review of the facts of the case. Specifically deal with the fact that we have a multi-level decision-making process here with both the faculty and the chancellor of the institution at question and the Board of Regents all having a say at different places.
Does the chapter that you referred to, Chapter 36, provide in any way for discovery?
Discovery in UWSIS 4, the board has the interpretations of UWSIS 4 have allowed a professor to engage in certain kinds of discovery as part of proving his factual case before the committee members. So yes, there is a provision for discovery at that level. There is also a provision for discovery at this court level, at the judicial review level, and that is found in 227.57. I feel I should clear up what might be a misconception, which is that the judicial review portions of Chapter 227 do indeed apply to this case. In fact, that's what we're here under. And the discovery provision to which Mr. Halstead referred, 227.57, which allows for discovery in certain procedural matters at the discretion of the court, is indeed applicable to this case, even though, as I've argued, the contested case procedures are not.
Do you think this court then should, as part of any decision, require that there be discovery, that the circuit court allow for discovery?
I believe that's what the Court of Appeals said, and I'm asking you to affirm the court.
Didn't they say May order?
Right. Well, that's true. And I think it is obviously discovery should be within the discretion of the trial court, so the trial court would need to determine whether or not it needed to permit discovery or hearing in this case. I have argued, Your Honors, that there is no need for further discovery because it's very clear what the Court of Appeal or what the Board of Regents relied on in its decision. I can explain that, but it requires me to start to address the due process issue in the case. So a little background. At the time the case was argued before the Court of Appeals, we presume the Court of Appeals had already decided that the 227 contested case procedures didn't apply, and therefore it asked the parties to address the question as to whether or not the Chancellor's appearance before the board had or could have violated the professor's right to due process. And so that question was briefed, and then that question was then argued before the board. We're talking here about what's called pre-termination process. That is to say that throughout the time that all of this is going on, including during the hearing before the faculty committee, during the hearing before the program review, the personnel review committee, matters committee at the Board of Regents, and at the time of the Chancellor's consultation, Professor Martyr was still on the staff. He was still being paid. He was on administrative leave. He wasn't teaching, but he was still receiving full salary. So that's pre-termination process. And as a matter of constitutional due process, the U.S. Supreme Court has long held that pre-termination process is fairly minimal as to what an employer must provide to an employee. What they must provide is the notice of the evidence that they have against the employee and an opportunity for the employee to respond. So what the court then did, what the Court of Appeals then did, was to analyze whether or not the appearance of the Chancellor before the Board of Regents did or could have violated his right to notice and an opportunity to respond.
Counsel, didn't the Chancellor in this case kind of skip a step in the procedural posture? I'm looking at UWS 4.07, that within 20 days the Chancellor shall prepare a written recommendation following the meeting with the faculty member unless his or her proposed recommendation differs substantially from that of the committee. If the Chancellor's proposed recommendations differ substantially from those of the faculty hearing committee, the Chancellor shall promptly consult with the faculty hearing committee and provide the committee with a reasonable opportunity for a written response prior to forwarding his or her recommendation. Would we even be in the same posture? Would we be here if that had taken place?
It did take place, Your Honor, but the committee didn't want to meet with the Chancellor. I can refer you to the Regents' decision in this case, which lays out the process of exactly what happened. And In response to that issue, the committee's decision on page 2 says, Chancellor Erlenbach consulted with the chair of the faculty committee and offered the committee the opportunity to respond to his position. The committee chair declined to make further response but did provide a responsive letter to the Board of Regents. So the Board of Regents had that letter. The committee chair had an opportunity to respond, but he didn't take that. And that evidence for that is found in the chancellor's the chancellor made a record of that attempted communication in a letter to UW System Chancellor Catherine Lyle.
I'm sorry, where in the record is that?
It's on the appendix to the plaintiff's brief, the Regent's decision, page 166, at the top. So back to the due process question. Essentially what the Court of Appeals then went on to determine was whether or not pre-termination process had been violated by the fact that the Chancellor spoke with the Board of Regents, an action which, as we've all noted and as Justice Butler noted earlier, was required by UW System 4. UW System 4 sub 8 said if the Board is going to take a position in opposite to the Chancellor, it should first consult with him. I was the counsel at the time, and I interpreted the PMRC's recommendation of dismissal of the charges to invoke that provision. So that was the thinking at the time of how that read. In any event, what the Court of Appeals did was rely on a number of federal cases, the most important one being the Stone case cited in both of our briefs, to say that the only way that the notice and opportunity to respond provisions, which are the only provisions that attach in pre-terminated process, could have been violated, would have been if the Chancellor had provided new and material evidence and information to the board during his consultation. The Court of Appeals then elected to send that issue back to the trial court to determine whether the Chancellor indeed had provided such information. I argued at the time that there was no need for that because the Board of Regents had laid out in its lengthy decision, which we've just been looking at, exactly what information and what reasons that it was relying on to support its termination action. And so we know that it was not relying on anything new and material that the Chancellor had provided. However, we didn't appeal that decision of the Court of Appeals to you because we're not at all afraid of what the trial court will discover should there be discovery on that issue.
Could I ask you on the statutory interpretation issue? If we didn't have 3613.5, would a dismissal come under the language of 227 and be a contested case hearing?
Only if you also didn't have UW-SIS 4. But if you had no process whatsoever, then I do believe that that under the MMSD decision would be the fallback hearing process that would be applied where a substantial interest is involved, and I'm not going to argue that losing one's job isn't a substantial interest.
So you're saying without 3613.5, the provisions of 227 would apply, is that
without
right?
Without 3613 sub 5 and without UW SIS 4.
Okay. Now, under 3613 sub 5, do you think the university is entitled to promulgate a rule that is in direct conflict with 227?
No. Yes. I mean, it could promulgate a rule that's in direct conflict with contested case procedures if they don't apply, but it could not promulgate a rule that's in conflict with federal due process, or with state or federal constitutional due process. But if 227 didn't apply, then yes, it could adopt another procedure that was in conflict with that. Those are only procedural requirements.
What is the phrase, shall be promulgated by rule under Chapter 227?
That refers, Your Honor, to the the first part of 227. And I know it's confusing because there's three separate and distinct chapters within that section. The first part of 227 refers to rulemaking, and so what the legislature intended by that was to tell the Board of Regents to promulgate rules through the rulemaking process laid out in 227. And it frequently says that throughout the statutes when it's instructing agencies to engage in rules. It says do it in accordance with 227, that being the rulemaking provision.
Counsel, what portion of, if I follow Justice Cross's question, of either Section 36 or Rule 4 allows for ex parte communications?
Rule 4, subsection, I'm sorry, UW System 4, subsection 8. And now, here's a question, too, Your Honor, because I'm, as I've said, I'm asking you to affirm the Court of Appeals decision. The Court of Appeals read that decision as saying, or read that rule, UWS subsection 8, as incorporating UWS subsection 4, which is the hearing process. And the hearing process does have a rule prohibiting, essentially prohibiting ex parte communications. And so under their, under the Court of Appeals interpretation, the Board of Regents still should have consulted with the Chancellor, still had to consult with the Chancellor, but should have permitted Professor Martyr to be present.
And you're not challenging that?
And we are not challenging that. And we intend in the future to follow that interpretation unless, of course, this Court comes out with a different one.
How far is it between Superior and Milwaukee?
We do everything by time here, right? I don't know, 7 hours.
Well, I mean, how long does the plane flight last?
Oh, I don't know. One of the things about 227 judicial review, the third part of the statute, is that you're not supposed to take up facts outside the record, which that fact most certainly is. We have attempted to offer our own facts outside the record to talk more about what was discussed in that, but that attempt was perhaps rightly rebuffed by the circuit court. But I do want to address that issue because nobody, not the Court of Appeals and not the trial court, ever believed that a party ought to be able to get discovery based on the private conversations of public officials without any evidence that they had acted improperly. What the law holds in Withrow versus Larkin, that's the U.S. Supreme Court, what the courts in Wisconsin have held in Bracegirdle and others are that public officials are entitled to a presumption that they're acting appropriately. I mean, we're talking about the member of the Board of Regents and the Chancellor of the University, they are entitled to the presumption that they acted appropriately. And they were both from Superior. The Regent saved the state a few bucks by giving the Chancellor transportation to the meeting. But there's no evidence anywhere, much less the compelling evidence that they talked about this case.
Let me ask this. It's your position that it's proper, or at least it's not improper, for the Chancellor to have met with the entire board without counsel for the other side being present. Is that right?
It was before the Court of Appeals ruled, Your Honor, but I'm accepting that ruling.
Would it be proper for the Chancellor to meet with the three-member committee of the board?
I would assume under the Court of Appeals interpretation that all of those meetings on the case, I mean, obviously the Chancellor is going to have to meet with the Board of Regents and other regents on other matters, but because they have to, they work together and they need to be able to discuss those things. But on the case, I would interpret the way the Court of Appeals has analyzed the rule as that on this case there shouldn't be any meetings.
Before the Court of Appeals acted, were chancellors meeting with the three-member committee of the board that was reviewing dismissals?
No.
that would be improper?
It would be improper under the Court of Appeals ruling, yes. And it didn't happen.
But before the Court of Appeals ruling?
Before the Court of Appeals ruled, there was no regulation regarding whether or not the Chancellor could speak with the three-member board, member committee. However, there wasn't a rule requiring it either, and so they didn't. And there's no evidence that the Chancellor did do that, and he didn't. And I wouldn't, had I been asked, I would have said, don't do that because even the appearance is bad.
It's a hypothetical question.
Yeah.
The Chancellor, in your view, can meet with the whole board, ex parte. You said the Chancellor theoretically didn't have any rule prohibiting meeting with the three-member committee. So why should we presume that the Chancellor couldn't meet with one member of the board and discuss the matter?
I think this section, if I can clear up the confusion, the section she operates on is 4.08(2), which says after the hearing. So things that would go on before the board heard the matter don't come under that section, correct?
Correct.
So it's after the full hearing before the final decision.
Right, and so there's no rule addressing it. But, I mean, you're asking me to answer something that's both counterfactual and...
Am I just terribly cynical that a chancellor from Superior and a regent, I think, from Superior fly from Superior to Milwaukee, and then in Milwaukee... the regent from Superior makes a motion that the chancellor from Superior wants. Am I just cynical to kind of suspect that they might discuss this?
Yes. I mean, there isn't... yeah. I mean, all I can say is there's a presumption that these people acted appropriately. And, you know, they've tried to introduce evidence that they acted appropriately, but been prohibited.
If I could follow up Justice Blackson's question, because I think I understand where he's going with this. There's, I think, the concern that it may look inappropriate, whether it is in fact or not. And wouldn't that be the appropriate place to apply discovery to determine whether there was anything inappropriate?
Right, and the answer is no, because what you need to have is some compelling evidence that they acted inappropriately, and here there's none. There's nothing.
So the smell test isn't good enough?
The smell test is not good enough. What the court has said in Brace Girdle, what the Court of Appeals said, what the Supreme Court has said in Withrow versus Markham is that you need to have compelling evidence. And here there was none. And you understand that. I mean, the world would fall apart if we started to say that, you know, every time something that, you know, every time officials got together for other purposes, their conversations were open to discussion because it turns out that they both voted the same way. concern that I have, to get back to the initial 227 question, Your Honors, is not, as I explained in my brief, that it would affect the outcome of this case, because I think I've demonstrated that that the process that the professor was accorded in this case comported with the requirements of 227 contested case procedures. It's a fairly vague kind of statute and that incorporates a number of different process models, including the one that was applied in this case. What I am concerned about, Your Honors, is that you adopted something that would require contested case proceedings to apply to pre-termination process in general. And that is why, to address the question as to what we're so afraid of with the application of 227, that is what we're afraid of. It wouldn't change the outcome in this case at all. But no No courts have ever applied 227 process to pre-termination procedures. To post-termination procedures, yes, there's a procedure that applies. But to pre-termination procedures, you can imagine the problems that we would have. Normally, what we give in pre-termination procedure in civil service is the notice, the opportunity to respond, and then, frankly, always the decision maker meets with the supervisor outside of the presence of the employee. The supervisor gives the recommendation, explains why, and the decision maker makes the decision. So that's your typical pre-termination process, totally constitutional. If 227 contested cases applied in that matter, you would have every state employee, every time it wanted to take any discipline that might result in termination, even short of termination, having to engage hearing examiners and hold full-blown fact-finding hearings. And I suggest that that makes the ability of the state to get rid of people for misconduct or incompetence extremely unwieldy and difficult, such that I don't know what, you know, they're not going to have much time to do the things that they're supposed to do. So that is the fear with the 227 process and not how it would affect this case. I think it doesn't affect this case, and as this court and others have held, because there's an alternative process that's adequate and available.
Counsel, let me ask you the same question I asked opposing counsel regarding the reading of the two statutes together, because I think we have an obligation to harmonize to remove any conflicts if we can. I've already posited one construction that might harmonize the statutes in your favor, but I can also envision a harmonization that would lead to a conclusion opposite your position, that why could you not read 227 consistent with 36 and with UWS 4 in such a way that they're all read together and blended so that 227 could indeed apply?
You could do that, but then you have, well, first of all, you have the problem that you've previously said that's not what 227 is for. But you also, then you also have the problem as to, well, all right, okay, so it applies in this case, but what happens with all those other pre-termination processes that I've described? I mean, those people, your average peon civil servant, I think, has a substantial interest in his employment, too. So it leads to an unwieldy result, and not one that I suggest is apparent in the statutory scheme. One thing I wanted to point out with regard to the process here, I want to reiterate, is that the UWS process that was applied in this case was the result of a collaborative effort with faculty and the UW system in developing the process. It's modeled on a national process that's put forth by the American Association of University Professors, and these professors and academic staff at the university system are the only government employees who enjoy the ability to continue to be paid throughout the whole process. The rest of us get fired first, and then we engage in our process. So it is a very beneficial process to the professors, even though they don't like it in this case. I think I just need to address the remedy issue. We are, as I've said, completely comfortable with the remedy that's been proposed by the Court of Appeals in this case, because we know that no material evidence was introduced. We have nothing to fear by having the spotlight turned on that. The remedy that Professor Martyr proposes is that he be immediately reinstated with back pay. And I suggest, Your Honor, there's no law compelling that kind of remedy. And in fact, it's not available in the very process that's in front of you. You received this case under 227 judicial review, and 227 judicial review remedies, as you know, are extremely limited. And they are limited in the chapter in the section cited to you in, I think it's 59. But specifically, the one that goes to a procedural defect, which I think we all agree is what we have here, that remedy is for a remand to the decision maker. That's the remedy that the legislature has said that the courts should apply. There is a provision in 59 sub 5 that more broadly talks about setting aside the action of the Board of Regents in this case. But that remedy only applies if you find that that they misinterpreted, that they made an error of law, and that a proper interpretation of law compels setting aside the decision. And there has never been a finding ever, certainly not cited by Professor Martyr, and I couldn't find anything, that in a procedural civil process question that the decision underlying is completely reversed and the decision set aside. There's nothing compelling reinstatement. And I suggest that that's extraordinarily bad policy. I mean, I realize that we got caught up in some vagaries of language here that caused us to read something differently than somebody else did. But to elevate that to a decision where you put back to work with back pay someone who the Board of Regents has found to be have committed misconduct and to have violated the just cause statute would be extraordinarily bad policy for both the taxpayers, the students at UW-Superior, and the faculty there. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Rebuttal.
There were some questions that were asked both of me and of counsel for the board relating to the relationship between UWS 4, which the board was entitled to adopt under Chapter 36, and the relationship between that administrative code and the contested case statute. The legislature said very specifically in Section 227.03 sub 4, the type of proceedings that are not subject to contested case treatment. And they cite very specific statutory proceedings under Chapter 48, Chapter 938, and Chapter 302, where they say the provisions of this chapter related to contested cases do not apply to proceedings involving, et cetera, et cetera. So the legislature has already identified the type of proceedings that are not contested cases, and it did not identify termination proceedings under Chapter 36. In addition, in Section 227.42 sub 1, the legislature further said that the right to a contested case hearing is in addition to any other right provided by law. And so the fact that there's a right to a hearing under UWS 4 does not mean that the board gets to decide that it's going to throw out the window everything the legislature has said under Chapter 227 contested case proceedings. And
Counselor, could you address opposing counselor's argument to us that if we adopt your view, a state can never fire a state employee without giving them a full hearing beforehand?
Every person who's a tenured faculty member, which are the narrow facts of this case.
I don't want to talk about a tenured faculty member. I want to talk about the broader concept that was put forth to us in opposing counsel's argument. You didn't have a chance to address that the first time around, and I'm wondering if you agree with her view.
I agree that any person who any person who has a substantial interest that is affected or determined adversely by a decision or order of an agency is entitled to a contested case proceeding. Now, what distinguishes Dr. Martyr and tenured faculty from what I think was referred to as your average civil servant is that not every employee who is employed by the state of Wisconsin has a protected property interest, and that's the difference.
Why not?
Because the United States Supreme Court has said that if you do not have a legal expectation of continued employment, then you don't have a protectable employment right that would be considered substantial interest.
So if they're an employee at will, then I understand your argument. What about if it's an employee that has a 3-year contract and gets terminated before it's up?
Then that person would in fact have, if you have a 3-year contract that's not a rolling contract, in other words, one that needs to be renewed, then you have an interest, a protectable property interest in the remaining portion of that contract, depending upon the point in which you're terminated. And if that would then be for this court to determine whether that would constitute what the statute defines as a substantial interest.
Well, what about just contract law? I mean, if you got a contract and you don't work for the state and someone terminates you, you can argue you weren't terminated for cause and bring a cause of action yourself in court for a breach of contract, correct?
In court or through arbitration.
But if we adopt your argument, then don't we fall back into the statutory scheme for a separate remedy?
We're talking, Justice Robinsack, if you are speaking of state employees, okay, state employees who have a property interest and that could be construed as a substantial interest by this court under Section 227.01 would be entitled to a contested case hearing.
Would that include non-probationary state employees?
There are a wide variety of classifications of non-probationary state employees. Many of them would have a right, an exclusive right to arbitration under a collective bargaining agreement, so we would never be into this scheme. In fact, there is an exclusion in 227.03 that relates to proceedings before the Employment Relations Commission in matters that are arbitrated under Chapter 230. That's in 227.03 sub 7. And so you're talking about a whole group of state employees that are accepted already from the statute by the legislature. Now, I want to talk about a couple of things. I have limited time. First of all, counsel for the board referred you, Justice Butler, to Appendix 166 of Dr. Marder's appendix. That contains no document that shows that the chancellor gave a written proposal to the campus committee before he sent his recommendation to the board. All it does is it says that the board alleged that in its decision, but there are no facts in the record that support that. I see my time has expired.
All right. Thank you, counsel. That concludes case 03-AP-2755, Marder versus the Board of Regents of the UW system. We're going to take a brief recess to allow the students to leave if they so desire, and we'll be out shortly. Thank you.